I think not everyone was here last week when we started here. So just to review a little bit, this is Shobo Genzo Hosho, Dharma nature, or the nature of things, the nature of phenomena. This is the Japanese way of saying Dharmata. And one of the main places where this term Dharmata is defined is Asanga, the great Yogacara founder, Asanga's treatise called Distinguishing Dharma and Dharmata. Dharma Dharmata Vibhaga. And so it's distinguishing Ho and Ho-sho. And here's Asanga's definitions of Dharma is that which is classified as Dharma or phenomena is samsara. That which is classified as Dharmata, or the nature of things, or pure being, is nirvana, transcendence of suffering, as this is defined by all the vehicles of Buddha Dharma. The traits of Dharma or phenomena are defined as duality of perceiver and perceived, plus the assumption that such an appearance of duality actually exists in that way. This is the definition of Dharma, or phenomena. And the other factor, Dharmata, is defined as suchness, intimate self-aware wisdom in which there's no differentiation between perceiver and perceived, a signifier and a signified. So this is Dharma and Dharmata, things and the nature of things. And Asanga goes on to say, these two are not one and the same, nor do they differ. Because a distinction exists conventionally between Dharma and Dharmata, and yet does not exist ultimately. So this is a little background on things and the nature of things. We have many similar terms in our tradition, such as samsara and nirvana, such as form and emptiness, such as difference and unity, and in this case, it's dharma and dharmata.
Not make a distinction when we talk about Dharma? Don't we usually, wouldn't we translate Dharma as things as they are?
Dharmata is more like things as they are. And Dharma, as we talked about last week, is a very dynamic Sanskrit word that has multiple meanings. And in English, we sometimes talk about Dharma with a small d, which means things or phenomena, multiplicity of things. In the Abhidharma, there's like 75 or 100 dharmas, like form, feeling, perceptions. It's all the phenomena that make up our experience. And from the Mahayana point of view, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. Mm-hmm. So their true nature is actually dharmata, or suchness. So dharmas as phenomena are not so much things as they are, but things as they aren't. Things as we perceive them to be, but which is not really the way they are. We perceive them to be like, I'm over here and you're over there, and we're, you know, separate phenomena is usually how we perceive dharmas. But the nature of these dharmas is that there is no separation between them and no abiding characteristics or reference points by which we can get a hold of things. So I would say, like, things as they are might be a nice translation, actually, of dharmata. Things as they are is kind of like, or things as it is more like suchness. Yeah, so this is background on this term, which is not a term that Dogen made up, right? Dharma nature, or the nature of things. And so let's jump back to where we left off, which is about a third of the way down this first page. All Buddhas, all Bodhisattvas, and all sentient beings clarify the great road of all Dharma nature with the power of knowledge by birth. And they clarify the path of Dharmata with the power of knowledge by birth, or innate knowing. And this is also came up last week, this knowledge by birth, which Dogen seems to be implying that is this kind of like a natural kind of wisdom that's always with us, whether we know it or not. Like maybe not exactly the same as Dharmata, but maybe the same as Dharmata, or we could say it's what realizes Dharmata. It's the wisdom, the knowing that knows suchness directly. So this knowledge by birth, our true nature of our mind, and without having all Buddhas, all Bodhisattvas, and all sentient beings clarify this great path of Dharma nature with the power of knowledge by birth. In other words, we clarify Dharmata with our true Buddha nature. That you clarify the great road of Dharma nature with a sutra and a teacher is no other than clarifying Dharma nature by yourself. So this is also a theme that Dogen began in the very first sentence of this essay about studying Dharma with teachers or sutras, which is this way we think of as learning how things are through the wisdom of those in the past who've realized it and passed it along. You could say that's what sutras are, right? They're the Buddha's unique and subtle understanding of the nature of things, that even though long before the Buddha everyone had knowledge by birth, still you could say the Buddha was the first to discover and expound it in this particular way, and that gets passed along as the sutras, and then Dharma teachers are doing the same thing, are a live version of presenting the sutras, or in the Zen we might say presenting understanding outside of the sutras, but that's based on the sutras. So this issue of teacher, do we get this knowing through teachers or sutras, or is it knowing by birth? I think this dynamic is what Dogen's been exploring for a while here. And here he says that you clarify this path of Dharma nature with a sutra and with a teacher is no other than clarifying it by yourself. So it's, I think, an interesting thing that Dogen brings up in some other places too, about how it's not so much that there's some knowledge that's getting handed to us by a sutra or a teacher, and yet without a sutra or a teacher, it's not just like we don't need anything to access this clarification of Dharmata. And to bring out some other places where Dogen brings up this dynamic of this kind of, it, we already have this innate knowing, and yet what's this relationship with teachers and sutras? There's one in Shobo Genzo's Shisho, Document of Heritage, where Dogen says, when you have the seal of realization from a Buddha, you have realization without a teacher, realization without self. This being so, it is said, a Buddha receives realization from a Buddha, an ancestor merges realization with an ancestor. And Dogen says, it's impossible to give this seal of realization without being a Buddha, and to become a Buddha without receiving the seal of realization from a Buddha. So it's like everyone is already abiding in Dharma nature, Samadhi, as Dogen will go on to say. And what is this meeting with the Buddha's Dharma through sutras or teachers? We speak of it's like a way to access, to like kind of unlock the Dharmata that's already here. It's not giving us anything we don't have. Teachers and sutras, it's said in Zen, are like the fingers pointing at the moon. And so the moon is always here, but we often don't recognize it. So what is this pointing out, and what are these teachers and sutras? It may be that we could say the teachers or sutras are those who point out that they themselves, the teachers and the sutras, are not separate from us. It's almost like we're living in a world of separation, and then something that appears separate from us, like a sutra over here, says, actually, I'm you. Or a teacher says, actually, I'm you. And we realize, actually, that wasn't somebody else saying that. That was me saying that to myself, but yet it came from what appeared to be, at first, someone or something else. So that is, it's quite a dynamic thing to talk about, and Dogen, I think, is quite into this point about nobody can give you this, and yet this relationship with seemingly other is like essential. Another fascicle of Dogen's is Jisho Zamai, or self-realization samadhi. And here Dogen says, you let go of yourself for the sake of Dharma without knowing how many thousands of times you do so. You seek Dharma for the sake of yourself without knowing in how many billions of eons you do so. This is the vital activity of following a teacher. This letting go of yourself. Kind of startling. This is the activity of practicing yourself and following yourself. In this way, at the time of Buddha's blinking his eyes, there is the smiling of Mahakashapa. And so on. This essay in particular, I think, is quite interesting about this. The whole essay, in a way, I feel like, is kind of various old stories about this relationship of between realization on one's own and confirmation, meeting with a teacher. There's some interesting stories in here. This practice of Buddhas can cannot be experienced with the body without receiving it from a teacher, even if you have knowledge by birth. So almost the same as our current essay. Knowledge by birth does not know knowledge beyond birth, and beyond knowledge beyond birth. Even those who have knowledge by birth would not know the great way of Buddha ancestors unless they study it. To experience yourself with the body and to experience others with the body is the great road of Buddha ancestors. Just turn the study of your beginner's mind and study simultaneously with others' beginner's minds. When self and others study together with beginner's mind, you arrive together at the ultimate realm. In this way, your own endeavor encourages the endeavor of others. So, it's a big topic in itself. And I think an important one for Dogen, and thus his emphasis on the lineage of the Buddhas and ancestors. And yet, there's nobody outside us who can ever give us anything. You have to realize this completely yourself, all alone. Alone is, when you break it into two parts, is all one. Sutras are Dharma nature that is you yourself. So this is kind of what we're talking about here. A teacher is Dharma nature that is you yourself. Dharma nature is a teacher. Dharma nature is you yourself. So it's also kind of interesting here that we said at this point that the sutras are pointing out this particular teaching called Dharma nature. That's who we already are. But they're like doing it through words and teachers through words or gestures or some kind of meeting. They're also pointing out this Dharma nature. But the sutras themselves are Dharma nature. You could say there is Dharma nature that's also doing this particular thing, is functioning as Dharma nature to point out Dharma nature. Does that make sense? Like the sutra, even before you open it, just the book itself is just radiant Dharma nature. But then you open it, and then there's these words that say, this is Dharma nature. And so the Dharma nature is expressing through a, you know, in this case of sutras, a kind of conceptual pointing out of Dharma nature. But even before you open the book, the covers already like just radiant Dharma nature. And same with teacher, before they say anything, or when they're just being obnoxious, they're actually Dharma nature that is you yourself. Dharma nature is you yourself. Because Dharma nature is you yourself, it is not you tempted by those outside the way or a group of demons. I think this is a kind of an awkward translation. The other translations are say more something like, because Dharma nature is you yourself, it is not the self conceived of by those outside the way.
That's a whole lot more clear.
Yes, much more clear.
What translation is that?
That's the other two that we have are Thomas Cleary and Nishijima.
Oh, okay.
And both of them use the word conceived.
Okay.
Would you say that again?
So, because Dharma nature is you yourself, it's not the self, or you, conceived of by those outside the way, or a group of demons. So it's... Here I think we're also playing a little bit with this. Jiko is this you yourself. The self in the Zen sense of like big self. Teacher Tangen Roshi in Japan had these phrases he'd like to use over and over again. It's Honrai no Jiko, which is like original self, And this is not to be confused with like the Atman, or the, like we call like the ego self, small self, which is a different Chinese character. Ga is usually used to translate like Atman. But self's a dynamic word, right? Usually when you see in Japanese ji, like jiju zamai, like the self receiving samadhi, it's this bigger self. And when it's ga, it's like small self. Not always the case, but generally. So here we're talking about you yourself in the sense of big self. But here I think Dogen's playing with the word self. Because Dharma nature is you yourself, it's not the self conceived of by those outside the way. It's not the Atman conceived of by the Tirthakas, are those outside the way. In Indian philosophy, those who believed in this kind of an eternal essence of self called the Atman, that's comes and goes. I mean, that doesn't come and go as we come and go. And as you know, the Buddha taught Anatman, this is turning of this view of the self conceived of by those outside the way. So this Dharma nature that's you yourself is not that kind of self conceived of by those outside the way, or a group of demons, or Ma is like related to Mara, not the kind of self that Mara says you have some abiding true essence. Dharma nature has no outside the way and no demons. Kind of a nice little footnote. Those who tempt us into like some sort of delusion that seems very close to realization, actually Dharmata doesn't have anybody or anything outside itself. It doesn't have those who are outside the way. It doesn't have any outside of itself. And it does, therefore it doesn't have any maras or demons. It's just that you have a morning meal, you have a midday meal, and you have tea. Or it's just, maybe another translation is, Dharma nature doesn't have these demons and outsiders. It's just having breakfast, having lunch, having tea. So, that's the kind of thing this Dharma nature is. However, those who call themselves students for two or three decades keep being dumbfounded upon hearing a discussion on Dharma nature. They pass their lives in this way. Now, we can't really have a Dogen fascicle without a little rant. So this is Dogen's time for his rant.
Not the perception of being separate.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, you know. He goes back and forth between, it starts seeming like this, and then, no, it's just our ordinary activities of breakfast, lunch, and tea. And then, just so we don't fall into this, well, then everything's it. Well, there's many people who don't get this. It's not so simple. Don't cover your ears and walk away thinking that we're all finished now. Another translation is, those who call themselves students for two or three decades pass their life in a daze as they hear about Dharma nature. And I think it's kind of interesting, just particularly that reading of it is like, even if we're understanding it or and feel enlivened by this understanding and contemplation, still then we hear things like Dharmata. It just becomes like a word. Or, you know, I think of like, we chant the Heart Sutra every morning here. And over and over, we recite these lines like form itself is emptiness and emptiness itself is form. It's like one of the most profound statements I think that could ever be made in the realm of human beings. And yet, form itself is emptiness, emptiness is self-form. I kind of like, often I feel like I'm chanting that sutra in a daze. I'm chanting the words, but like, that's not striking me. The truth of those words is so easily just passed by. We get so used to it. Those who call themselves long-timers in monasteries who are seated in a large teaching chair can only climb in and out of a pit of confusion with their bodies and minds when they hear the voice of Dharma nature and see its form. I think another, this is a little bit awkward translation too, another one is, when they hear the voice of Dharma nature and see its form, their body and mind, their subjective and objective experience, always just rises and falls in the pit of confusion. So it's more like, though they're hearing and seeing Dharma nature all the time, their bodies and minds are meanwhile arising and ceasing, you could say, in the pit of confusion. In other words, we're just like, our lives are just rolling along, we're getting older, we're, our bodies and minds come and go in the pit of confusion, meaning like we're not really seeing this Dharma nature, even though it's coming into our eyes and ears all the time.
But what is Dharma nature's form?
Yeah, well, I think this essay will continue to explore this. Because we might think that Dharma nature would have no form, right? So even as Asanga pointed out when talking about Dharma and Dharmata, he says, we can't say that they're the same phenomena in their nature, and yet we can't say that they're different or separate either. They dependently arise. So therefore, colors and sounds are not separate from Dharma nature, and yet they're not the same as Dharma nature either. But this relationship will keep going into this. Yeah, how does it come to us while we're having breakfast and lunch and tea and tasting that gomashio? Their reaction proves, I guess their reaction is the bodies and minds rising and falling in the pit of confusion. Their reaction proves that they mistakenly think that Dharma nature emerges even after the three realms and the 10 directions we live in collapse. They also mistakenly think that such Dharma nature is separate from all phenomena in this moment. Well, here's one statement already, right? They think that Dharma nature emerges after the three realms, which is like all the worlds of samsara, and the 10 directions of the phenomenal world, cease, and then we realize Dharma nature. We hear teachings like that, especially the early teachings of the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths even really emphasize the third noble truth of realization, sometimes equated with nirvana, and awakening and freedom, is actually called nirodha, or cessation. And you could say it sounds like in that first sutra that we chant that it's just talking about the cessation of suffering. But in those early teachings, the cessation of suffering really includes like the cessation of the five skandhas. It's like complete cessation, actually, of everything that we call experience. And therefore, and then the unborn, undying nirvana is realized. This is like the classic early Buddhism. So people think that. And even in Zen, we hear like, drop off body and mind and realize the way. It's like body and mind have to cease completely. People start thinking this way and they fall into a pit of confusion. So this three realms and 10 directions that we live in collapsing to reveal Dharma nature reminded me of this case number 30 in the Book of Serenity. Daswe's aeonic fire. This is, I think, a wonderful story where a monk asks Daswe, when the fire at the end of the kalpa rages through and the whole universe is destroyed or annihilated, is this destroyed or not? And so this is referring to Buddhist cosmology, again, where you have these long, long periods of time called kalpas, or eons, and they're impermanent, and they have the particular cycle of like a kalpa is born. Maybe quantum physics could align with, you know, modern cosmology might align with this, like the Big Bang, we could say, is the birth of our particular kalpa. Maybe it's a little different from, because maybe modern cosmology doesn't say, well, there were many Big Bangs. But this may be kind of like the Dharma story. There were many Big Bangs, and we're just discovering this one of our kalpa, where the universe arose and expanding, and then some physicists say it reaches a maximum. I know there's different versions here, but some say it kind of reaches its like balloon-like, you know, stretch, and then it starts contracting again, and it comes back into this single point of like the reverse Big Bang, and we're somewhere in the middle of this. That's a little bit like the old Indian story that the kalpa arises and it ceases in this giant firestorm, and all the elements, earth, wind, fire, water, are just go totally wild and destroy not just the earth but the entire universe. And then the whole universe, then there's nothing. The empty eon, say. And then another kalpa arises. So with this story, when this great firestorm at the end of the kalpa rages through the universe and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? I think it's a great question. Is this destroyed or not? It's, I think, quite relevant to our conversation, too. Is Dharma nature, does Dharma nature ever get destroyed? And it's kind of, not such a simple question, because if there's no form, you could say, if all form is destroyed, is emptiness destroyed or not? Well, how could there be emptiness without form? And yet, how can you destroy emptiness also? So it's an interesting question. The monk asks, is this destroyed or not? And Daswe says, destroyed. It is destroyed. The monk says, then it goes along with that, meaning the universe goes along with, or more like, this goes along with the universe when it's destroyed. And Daswe says, yeah, it goes along with that. This goes along with that. Kind of like the Buddha used to say things like that. When this arises, that arises. Mm-hmm. But this seems like not just another thing that arises.
It's rare to get such a definitive answer.
Well, then...
Then, okay.
A monk, maybe the same monk, maybe a different one.
You can't just rest in the satisfaction of some
Well, that conversation, I think, did close, and the monk went away satisfied. But then he went to another teacher, and asked Longji, when the fire at the end of the Kalpa rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? And Longji said, not destroyed. And the monk said, why is it not destroyed? And Longji said, because it's the same as the universe. Which I think is kind of strange, because if it's the same as the universe and the universe is destroyed, then wouldn't it be destroyed also? So this is now we're in the koan land. But I always thought, wouldn't it be nice if it said it's not destroyed because it's not the same as the universe? I thought that would make a nice pair with the first one. And later in the commentary here, it says this is the ancient commentary, it says some versions of this story say the opposite, that it's not the same as the universe. Even, which I was happy about, even though they chose this one. What did he say? Some comment about that.
Which number is that?
Case 30. Well, it's a double barrier, as I said. So that's I think a nice koan about this relationship between dharma and dharmata. When dharma is destroyed, is dharmata destroyed or not? Yeah, it goes along with that. No, because it's not the same as phenomena that are coming and going. Nirvana is not the same as samsara. When samsara is ended, is nirvana ended? No. Then someone might say, actually.
Well, it's emptiness.
Yeah. And that you can't have nirvana without samsara.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, especially in the Mahayana. That's coming up.
What is changing the feeling of destruction? Yeah. You know, I mean, just different energy. You know, the essence is still there, is what I'm trying to apply.
Well, that's a question, right? What is it? when we look at dharmata or the essence, and sometimes sho and hosho is people translate as essence, like the essence of all phenomena. Instead of nature, and just in English, I feel cautious about using the word essence in that way, because when you look up essence in the dictionary, it means something like the fundamental unchanging true quality of something. It might say even more than that. And so it's very similar to this dharmata, is kind of like an unchanging quality. But if essence kind of implies that there's something, like essence is sometimes used to translate svabhava, which means like own being or self nature or inherent existence. Mm-hmm. Inherent existence can be translated as essence. Inherent means like there's some true existence that inheres in something in a kind of ongoing way, like its essence. So if we think, like maybe quantum physics might say, the essence in things is maybe some like, they're just the dynamic movement of the energy of the electrons moving around, and there's no physical matter, but there's this energetic movement of electrons. I would say that's a little different in my understanding from the Dharma teaching, is that it's still like that energy is still something that you could measure, for example, whereas the nature of things is like unmeasurable and completely beyond description. But as a metaphor, it's similar maybe. But
nothing. So maybe like fluid energy is too much.
I think so, from a Dharma perspective. Yeah. We're talking about emptiness or the nature of things. And I know people try, I think it's a metaphor, I think when people talk about emptiness in quantum physics, which people are doing these days, I think it's close, but it's not, I wouldn't say it's exactly the same. I think it's a nice approach, but I think the problem is that that the quantum energy or something like that is still some, if we say it's an energy or a force, then it's still something. Quantifiable.
Actually, I think what I've been reading about is something called fields, like these fields that are where anything can, you know, things just arise, things disappear out of these fields. And so that sounds very similar to...
Maybe like that,
And, you know, rather than being nothing or something, there's just this... potential field, or something, or nothing.
So maybe like that.
It
gets dangerous to get into like modern physics,
because
it's so complex, and I'm not steeped in this area. But it's also interesting for sure, and we may find more and more similarities and differences. And I know people like the Dalai Lama's into these discussions with the scientists. Comparing and contrasting. So this it's a mistake to think that Dharma nature emerges after the three realms and the ten directions that we live in collapse, or the firestorm comes through and destroys the universe. It's a mistake to think that at that time there would just be pure Dharma nature. I also it just comes to mind right now, there's a nice a few nice articles in the new issue of Buddha Dharma magazine, and it's a kind of a theme of this issue about form and ceremonies versus like the pure unadulterated Buddha Dharma. It's like free of all forms, that I think in the West we're actually, a lot of people are looking for, and wanting all this cultural baggage. Can we just like drop that away and find this or Dharmata? And several people make this point that like it's that there is no such thing as like a pure Dharma without this stuff around it. There's actually nothing there. They always go together, like Dharma and Dharmata. Or like the center of a wheel is like the true ineffable suchness or Dharma nature. And then the wheel that revolves around it is all the cultural forms and ritual activities. And that the center never moves, actually, right? The very hub of the wheel is just unchanging, and then as it goes from country to country and century to century, that the forms change. But that if you take away all that and just have this one point of the center, there's nothing there, actually. It's only in this and if you take away the center and just have these forms, then it's this empty ritual and just a shell of meaninglessness. So it's also similar to this essay.
Don't get me started, actually, I shouldn't.
Do you want to not get started?
Well, I mean, there's always form. Even the people who say they don't want form, they have some kind of form.
Yes, yeah.
That's how we dwell in form.
Yeah,
We live in bodies.
And we have hundreds of secular rituals.
Yeah.
Like stopping when the light is red.
Yeah.
But one article I thought was nice, because people who like to have no form at all, they still, when they sit down for zazen, they have to take some particular posture. They could say, I'm not even going to. If you're in a room, you have to relate to a wall, and you're going to either decide to face the wall or not face the wall. And you're already engaged in form,
right there. Yeah.
And there's a tradition one way or the other, and you can say, I'm just flip a coin. But it's unavoidable.
The form of coin flip.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. So, having breakfast, lunch, and tea. We need to eat to live, and for Dharma nature to shine. the meaning of Dharma nature, or the way principle of Dharma nature, is not like that. Not like you have to destroy the universe for it to emerge. All phenomena, or 10,000 images, and Dharma nature go beyond arguments about whether they're the same or different, mm-hmm. about whether they're identical or separate. What is not past, present, and future, not permanent or impermanent, not form, mm-hmm. feeling, perceptions, formations, and consciousness, mm-hmm. is Dharma nature. So this, neither the same or separate is a key point in this whole, in the middle way. We could say those are two extreme views, is that like form and emptiness are the same, or Dharma and Dharmata are identical, is that actually kind of an extreme view, and the Dharma and Dharmata are separate is another extreme view. So the middle way is free from the extremes of identity and distinction, yeah, or sameness and difference. And that's why the middle way is so hard, because we're like, we feel settled if things are the same, and we can feel settled if things are different. They're nice, comfortable, usual definitions of things. But to settle in the realm that's not where these things are not the same and they're not different, and we can't say what exactly their relationship is very unsettling. So then we veer one way or the other. Mm-hmm. It's hard to stay in the middle because there's no ground. Mm-hmm. Free from identity and difference. Nagarjuna says the middle way is... So... all phenomena, or dharmas, and dharma-ta go beyond these arguments about sameness and difference, identical or separate. What is not past, present, and future, not permanent or annihilated, we might say. This is because in a way we say things are impermanent, so I think it's pointing out these views that those in the Buddha's time would proclaim that there is a permanent essence like an Atman, or that actually, as we are born and die, it never changes. And then another group of philosopher yogis who said, no, it's just at the end of this life, when the body dies and the mind dies, that's it. That's the end. It's like there's no more to that. What we call that person, that's kind of a view of annihilationism, like there's nothing left at that time. The other is that there is something that goes on and on. And then the Buddha's middle way doesn't fall into either of those extremes. When when asked, particularly about this issue of life after death, which we might say is not such a big deal for us, but maybe it ought to be something we at least consider. I think we will consider it at some point as we approach that moment. It will become a bigger issue, maybe, for us. Even when a great sutra in the Pali Canon where someone even asks the Buddha, as I understand your teaching, Blessed One, it's this consciousness, this very consciousness, that when life ceases, goes on from body to body. And I think this sutra is particularly interesting because later tradition talks about consciousness not as some thing, but it's related to consciousness, this non-self that... is born and dies. Right? So, but in this sutra, kind of about this rebirth question, a monk asks, as I understand, you teach there's no self, but there's consciousness goes from life to life, and the Buddha says, don't say that. I don't teach that. I think it's kind of an obscure sutra, but interesting in this discussion. And then the monk, because he's arguing, I think argues, yes, but you, I thought you do. And that, in a way, it's because that's the way I've understood it now, and it made sense. You're not going to take that away from me, are you? And the Buddha says, I think that something like, the monk says, well, then what? Then how does this work? And the Buddha says, dependent on ignorance, karmic formations arise. Dependent on karmic formations, consciousness arises. Mm-hmm. Dependent on consciousness, name and form. And this 12-fold chain of dependent co-arising, it might sound kind of like a cryptic answer, but in fact, that dependent co-arising is the Buddha's story of dependent on this arises. It's not like there's a consciousness going through. And yet, it's not annihilationism, because dependent on the cessation of ignorance, there's the cessation of karmic formations, or maybe more applicable, dependent on the cessation of this body and mind at the end of this life, there's a result. Every cause has a result. So this Dharma nature is not past, present, and future, not permanent or annihilated, or doesn't fall into the views of eternalism and nihilism, and it's not form, feeling, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. It's not the five skandhas. All five skandhas are marked by emptiness, and all five skandhas in their true nature are Dharma nature. So it's not that Dharma nature is the five skandhas, but the five skandhas are not separate from Dharma nature either. Then we have the story that this kind of central story here. Matsu, Zen master Daji of Jiangxi, said, no sentient beings have the need to come out of Dharma nature samadhi for innumerable eons. They stay in Dharma nature forever, wearing a robe, eating a meal, and exchanging words. These activities of the six sense roots are no other than Dharma nature. So, another translation is, all sentient beings have never left the Dharma nature samadhi. So this no need to is I don't know where Kaz and Peter Levitt why they chose that, because it that doesn't seem to be in the Chinese. It's more like they just do not leave or have never left. There's not so much an issue of whether they need to or not. It's kind of a little extra something to contemplate. You say they don't have the need to, because almost like, well, they could. They could come out of it, they just don't need to. But looks like the original is closer to something like, all sentient beings have never left the Dharma nature samadhi. And Thomas Cleary translates Dharma nature samadhi as absorption in the nature of things. Samadhi is, you know, the one-pointedness of mind and object, and a meditative absorption. And samadhi is another one of those words like dharma that that's quite dynamic and has different layers of meaning. Usually we refer to like meditative concentration. Samadhi is like when you're doing a particular practice where you settle into the present so completely that your mind and the meditation object become like not separate or one-pointed. one-pointed focus where nothing else is intruding on it, this kind of concentration. Usually we mean by samadhi, but samadhi is just a one-pointedness of mind and object. And when it's talked about in Abhidharma, like the universal dharmas, the universal phenomena of experience, that are universal meaning like every mind moment, every moment of experience has these universal dharmas. I don't think I can remember all of them offhand, but this like contact, like every moment of experience, and we're talking about dualistic experience, ordinary experience, there's contact of sense faculties and objects, or even in our sleep, we might say there's like a subtle duality of mind and object. Anyway, samadhi is one of these universal qualities. Every moment of experience has the quality of samadhi. So this is like, you know, even if we're totally distracted and thinking of a million things at once, total multitasking, like this has nothing to do with samadhi. Well, in this kind of other deeper meaning of samadhi, it actually, this experience is a one-pointed, has a quality of one-pointedness, like the mind is meeting its object, we might say. And the senses are meeting it. If we're looking this way and that still, in each moment, like the eye is meeting a color, there's this, in this moment of contact, there's a kind of samadhi. It's a little bit different meaning, but similar, and it may be that in our story here, and in general, maybe, when Dogen's talking about samadhi, like the self-fulfilling samadhi, we could look at these two different meanings. Like it's a particular practice. The Buddhas and ancestors are practicing this self-receiving its function samadhi. Like they're totally absorbed in the awareness of receptivity. They're receiving their self and they're totally aware of this. It's like a practice, but you could say, even if they're distracted from this deeper level, you could say there's this, the self is receiving its function. Mm-hmm. And I think this this Matsu statement kind of sounds like this, because he's saying all sentient beings have never left this Dharma nature samadhi, or absorption in the nature of things. They are always within the nature of things, wearing clothes, eating meals, and having conversations. Robe, though, actually, does, you know, is the character A that just means clothing, or in Japanese it's koromo, is this robe with these long sleeves. The priest robe with the long sleeves is called koromo, or in the Chinese reading of A, but it doesn't actually, it just means clothing. It doesn't mean like, it's not a Buddhist term. It's just, in English, we'd only use it that way, maybe in the Zen world. That's just called clothing. So it's not some special robe. I understand this. They're just all beings wearing clothes and eating food and having conversations are always within the nature of things. These activities of the six sense roots, the six sense faculties, are no other than Dharma nature. Or other translations say, the six sense faculties, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, and all activities are the nature of things. So that makes it even more inclusive. Basically, everything that's happening is never leaves the samadhi of Dharma nature, or absorption in the nature of things. So, slightly more extended version of the story, Matsu. Matsu is one of my favorite ancestors. He's just one of the really early Chinese ancestors. There was the sixth ancestor, Hui Neng, who met Nan Yue. And then Nan Yue passed the six ancestors' dharma on to Matsu. So he's that very early phase of Chinese Chan. And his name means horse ancestor. I don't know why. That's his name, his Dharma name. Baso in Japanese. Horse ancestor, which is will become relevant later when, because Dogen will do some word plays with the horse theme. Baso. We have a lot of great stories. I'm sure you all know various stories about Matsu, like Matsu and Nanyue were the ones who got involved in polishing the tile. Matsu was sitting zazen, and Nanyue, his teacher, started polishing a rock to make a tile. How can you make a Buddha by sitting zazen? It's a great story. And various other stories of Matsu, like ordinary mind is the way. It's Matsu.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, he's a great one. He's a great one. So this is like kind of longer Dharma talk. His book, Sun Face Buddha, is a nice translation of the record of Matsu. He says, this is after like a page of this talk already where he's going on about various things. Also, in this very same talk, he's talking about the ocean seal samadhi, where Dogen has a fascicle with his name that he quotes Matsu from the same Dharma talk. Here he says, it's in contrast to ignorance that one speaks of awakening. Usually we think of awakening from the sleep of ignorance. Since originally there is no ignorance, awakening also need not be established. All living beings have, since limitless kalpas long ago, been abiding in the samadhi of Dharma nature. While in Dharma nature samadhi, they wear clothes, eat food, talk and respond to things. Making use of the six senses, all activity is Dharma nature. It is because of not knowing how to return to the source that they follow names and seek forms from which confusing emotions and falsehood arise, thereby creating various kinds of karma. When within a single thought one reflects and illuminates within, then everything is the holy mind or
the
sacred mind. Yes. And I have to research this, but I imagine that when he says, within a single thought, one reflects and illuminates within, I guess that this is a translation of this term, ekko hensho, turning the light around and shining back, which was a popular term at this time of Chinese Zen that the ancestors used throughout. And if not, it's the same point, because he's saying, without knowing how to return to the source, we follow names and seek forms externally, creating all kinds of karma. So we could say, I think there's interesting points in the prelude and the appendix to this story that Dogen quotes. The prelude being, it's in contrast to ignorance that one speaks of awakening. Since originally there is no ignorance, awakening need not be established. Kind of sets the stage here when we're talking about awakening from the sleep of ignorance. If we can't, what is this ignorance we're trying to wake up from? Oh, we can name various things that we could call ignorance, right? Dualistic thought, that others are separate from me, and what's more, they're bothering me. In fact, as long as beings are separate from me, I think they will be bothersome to a greater or lesser extent. Sometimes, or else not bothersome, but like really, really, like I have to be with them right now. Where are they? Like that's the attachment and aversion, right? That we're, when beings are separate from us. We could say, oh, isn't that what ignorance is? But here, originally there is no ignorance. In other words, we can't find this separation, actually, between self and others. Therefore, awakening also can't be established. This is kind of classic Zen, right? It's like, it kind of undermines this project of awakening from delusion. When you can't find illusion, then what, you know, basically, we could say that is awakening, but we don't even need to use that word. The non-establishment of ignorance, we could say, is awakening, but awakening is also not established. Therefore, both of them drop away, and then there's just this. Can this be destroyed? Can anything harm it, like the firestorm at the end of the eon? Because if so, then it's not reliable anymore. It's just another samsaric phenomena. So that's the kind of like, that's the kind of warm up to the story of, well, we can't really find any ignorance, therefore we can't really establish any awakening either. And then kind of another way to put that is, all beings from beginningless time have been abiding in Dharma nature samadhi, wearing clothes, eating food, talking and responding. Everything is Dharma nature samadhi. And then we could say, this is in a way the central story, and it's kind of this thing, well, everybody's in it. Kaz says they have no need to leave it. Thomas Cleary and Nishijima said they don't leave it. Almost like they can't leave it. So what? I got problems. You know, that's a nice statement, but like, how does it help my life? How do I practice with this teaching? And it may be enough sometimes with this kind of teaching, we just hear it really deeply, or we hear it for the 14th time. And on the 14th time we hear it, we say, okay. Sometimes it takes 13 times before. That's why we like chant these same things over and over again. We keep studying over and over. And if we've heard this kind of thing over and over, it's worth hearing one more time. Maybe this is the 14th time of hearing this. But still, we could say, if we want some other tool, I mean, Zen, classically Zen is tries not to offer any like methods, because then they become established as something that we have to do to counteract something else and all of that mess we get into. But this is almost like a method, I would say. I understand this teaching, after he presents this, and is saying, even though all beings are abiding in this Dharma nature samadhi, it's because of not knowing how to return to the source that they become confused and they create all kinds of karma. Right. So then what's the practice here? When within a single thought one turns the light around and shines back, then everything is the holy mind, or we could say the Dharma nature samadhi. And we've talked about this practice before. Maybe you've all heard, because it's one of my favorite Zazen instructions, is turning the light and shining back. And I understand it like it's a kind of a particular exercise, actually. We just say like, look within, you know, we hear this kind of thing all over. Even Jesus says the kingdom of heaven is within, right? Let the light within you shine. I don't know if he's referring to this particular exercise, this particular method, but as I understand it, it's like we're First we just settle into the present moment, and we let go, and then we let go, and then we past thought come up and we let go, and then future thoughts come up and we let go, and we relax more and more, and we settle into the present, so present that we, the past and future are collapsing into it, just present moment, resting, so sweet. And then, you could say, well, part of the mind, or if we set the intention beforehand, we could say, now this little spirit of inquiry arises in the mind and says, now, what is this awareness of the present moment? So it's like awareness that's like focused on the present moment. It's almost like a meditation object, right? This present experience is the object, but it's like awareness is focused on this object. I think it's an excellent meditation object. There's other objects too, right? Like the breath in the present moment, but this is more like, you could do this if you're following the breath too. Same thing, the awareness is focused on the breath as the object, or the awareness is focused on the present moment as the object. Now there's this question arises once we're settled. Look back, turn the light of awareness back, and ask, what is this awareness? Or whose awareness is this? Or where is this awareness coming from? Or who is following the breath? Mm-hmm. Or who is present right now? I think all these versions are the same. I would say they are the same as turning the light around and shining back. Turning the light is the metaphor, is like the light of awareness is directed towards some object, like the present moment, and then it's turning it back to the source of where is this coming from? Where is awareness coming from? Or tracing back the awareness that's focused. Awareness is, these are just images, right? But like, it seems like awareness is directed outwards toward the object. Now kind of reverse the awareness, or like, it feels like a backward step, which is what Dogen calls it. Learn the backward step of turning the light around and shining back. And at that time, body and mind of themselves will drop away. And the Dharma nature face will manifest. So this is something you can try out in Zazen. I think it works most, it's most alive when we're already really like relaxed and present. I think to just come in, mind's going busy, okay, what should I do now? What can I do now? Where's my project? Oh, yeah, turn the light around, turn it back. Turn it back! Go! It's too clunky. It's a very subtle backward step. We're used to walking forward. But if we're already like, you know, it might be like, first we're, let's just let go for a while of all the past and future and the kind of the busyness of the day and the stuff that I'm trying to work through. Okay, we're settled into the present. And then often the problem is then we're so tempted to just, this is like the sweetest, just resting in the present moment. Why mess with it now? But you could say just for fun. Or we might have this kind of buoyant lightness of like, well, it's not really like, it doesn't feel like so much messing with it. It's a natural curiosity maybe arises of like, what is this anyway? Mm-hmm. Like that. And then just looking back, you know, we think, well, am I going to find like the source of the awareness? Like a little, radio announcer or a little antenna that's sending out the wave? No, not. If we find anything, then that's not it. Then we, mm-hmm. If we find something, then we say, well, who just found that? You keep going back and like this who that has no answer, but it has a different effect, I think, and it feels a little bit like backing up. One friend of mine that I was talking to about this, she said, I really like this Echo Hensho exercise too. When I think of that, I think of this old TV commercial of the Nesty plunge. This is from like the 80s or something. I don't know if you ever saw this commercial. Nesty's like this iced tea mix, right? And this TV commercial was like, as I recall, I remember as a kid seeing this. It's like this is people of, I think they like maybe drink the iced tea and like fall back into a lake and splash and into a pool or something. So basically fall backwards and splash into the water. And that ad is take the Nesty plunge. I thought, yeah, it's kind of like this falling back. This feeling of it into a pool of water, a cool water.
Can you say again what it's Echo?
Echo Hensho. EKO means turning the light. Echo. And Hensho means shining back. Turning the light, shining back. And at one point, we did a whole sesshin on Echo Hensho a year or two ago. And I collected which I can send people if you like, this is one of my research projects, all the ancestors' uses of this term Echo Hensho. You can search, you know, the Chinese canon with these characters, and like all our favorite ancestors used, like 20 different ancestors used this term Echo Hensho, and then the Japanese ones also. So it's in there, woven through our tradition. People might interpret it different ways, but no.
I'm not sure I understand. So you say you're looking who, so who?
Yeah, you're kind of asking who.
Who, so you say, okay, me.
Well, see, this is... Yeah. So this is a... That's
me, it's not you.
Thank you for asking. Yeah, this is to clarify this meditation. I think part of the reason we do it when we're in this really still present place is we have to make it, and it might take a while to warm up to making it as experiential as possible, with putting aside all our kind of like usual ideas. For example, like if we start examining, well, who is this, and we say me, well, what is that? Well, actually, that's just an idea of language. We have this idea with this one is me. But actually, in our really direct experience, especially in the present moment, if we say, who is this, putting aside all our preconceptions, who is this in my direct experience, without putting any words on it, maybe also not even looking for a word, even trying to, if we find any words, say, well, that's just a word. Like really almost feeling the direct experience. Who is this, what is this awareness particularly? If we go to who is this, we think it's the body. Well, but then we get asked, then who is aware of the body? Who? If we really do this and warm up to this more and more, there's no answer, right?
But and you get the experience and get, grounded deeper in your visceral, present.
And it becomes, I think, even just to do it a little bit, I find. There's a kind of wonder starts opening up, a kind of awe at like, this awareness is like amazing beyond amazing. And like when I'm going through the day directed outwards, it's still amazing, but I lose touch with the amazing quality. It becomes very practical. I got to do this and this, and it is amazing what we do all day long. But like the very nature of awareness, we're not thinking about that. That's the backward step, right? We're not like, well, who's actually doing, thinking all this stuff? And we turn it back, it's like, what is this?
It's
like dropping body and mind, but it's a process of delayering. You know,
the first
process of delayering the words and concepts and just dropping and dropping and dropping. And then when you think, oh, I dropped body and mind, boom, you're right back, you know.
Yeah, then you're back in a word and a concept.
Yeah,
yeah, so it's kind of like delayering, and you could say this echo hensho is words. It's a particular pointing, it's a finger pointing that is, I find, can be quite helpful. Without any words, it's like without any pointing, this is this thing of the teachers and the sutras and the Zen ancestors, right? It's like, then we're maybe just hanging out in the present, and it's still pretty good. But even to hang out in the present, somebody said, be here now. We got those instructions from Ram Dass.
Great instructions.
or whoever,
Ram
right?
Dass.
We get all kinds of meditation instructions. And we might have discovered on our own, but this is a little new turn. You could say, and again, we might say, is this turning the light around and shining back? Is this the same as completely resting in the present moment, or different then?
Mm-hmm.
And we might say, if we say it's the same, then that's maybe we're holding a somewhat extreme view. And if we say it's completely different, well, that can't be either, because there's this little different quality in the nesty plunge. It's in the Dzogchen tradition, my teacher Sogmi Rinpoche sometimes says it's like you're really, really tuned into your present experience, like your senses are all like this, directed towards the world of colors, sounds, smells, tastes, touchables. Really get a sense for like how our senses are kind of like moving out into the world and kind of touching the world like this. And after we kind of settle into that, now go like this. And I think same practice of like whose senses are these? What's the source of the senses? And whereas this can be a very like outer spaciousness, where kind of like maybe we've increased our peripheral vision, we have this sense of outer space, called the world, and this turning around is more like tuning into inner space, and it's not like some little brain nut that's in there. It's like, I was going to say bigger than outer space, but it's not really bigger or smaller. It's like equal size. They're both completely boundless, but this is like a boundless subject aware of a boundless object with boundless non-separation between them.
Yeah.
Relearning your ABCs, a bigger container, just sort of taking the backward step and then the backward step when you get caught in that one and then keep stepping back.
Yeah, a bigger container.
Just an observer, no judge.
Mm-hmm. A bigger, and if we find some edges of the container, like this is truly consciousness itself. Well, then let's look for ABC.
Yes.
A bigger container than that, till we find one that has no words on it at all.
My container is that easy, but I see it now. Another bigger one.
Yeah, yeah. Going beyond Buddha, Dogen talks of, is Buddha means going beyond the current version of Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the same, another, just to finish this point for now, on the turning the light around, shining back, I would propose, many of you heard, we had this whole year of studying the mirror, right?
Yes.
The mirror awareness,
yes.
Exactly the same.
Yes.
It's just a different metaphor. You are this boundless mirror that has no edges, and you're just total receptivity. And then there's all this stuff on the surface that's the outer phenomena reflected on the surface of the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like, we're so used to looking at the phenomena on the surface of the mirror, that's what we use mirrors for,
mm-hmm.
after all. But this is this backward step called, now look at the mirror itself. How can I? All I see is reflections. unusual thing. It's like turning the light around to the surface of the mirror, and or like being the surface of the mirror. Yes.
So it's not being aware of consciousness.
In a way, I think being aware, we could say it's being aware of consciousness. It's consciousness being aware of consciousness. But if we're doing this as a practice, then we say, now this is it. This is actually consciousness. Then we're putting it in a conceptual framework of words now, and we say, well, who just labeled that? It's like if ever we come up with like any story to put on it, we look for this bigger container, or this, you know, who is aware of that beyond in our direct experience? Because in a way, also this is consciousness is another conceptual idea that, like, I've heard about. I know what consciousness is. I've been studying it a while, and I think this is actually what they're talking about when they say consciousness. But now we're like just telling a story about it. So is it possible to just? Actually, it's very difficult to not tell a story. In a way, the vaster it gets, the more we want to tell a story about it. This is it! Like, this is what all the Buddhas and ancestors are talking about. Oh, great.
Well, there's another
Why do you have to
Zen
say
story
it?
Then where the master says, but isn't it a shame to have to talk about
it? Yeah, like that. Yeah. Yeah, like Suzuki Roshi says, you know, to say this flower is beautiful is to kill the flower. Mm-hmm. It's okay. I mean, we do it.
Yeah.
We will continue to do it. But anyway, that's part of the fun or the playfulness, I think, of this kind of practice is like, we can even ask, like, am I willing to like, just like, be the mirror without telling a story about the images on it, and without eliminating the images on it, like obliterating the three realms and the ten directions. They're right here, but this human mind is quite something. So. Tune in next week for another episode of The Nature of Things. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to enter
them. I wrote all over the paper, so I can't.